This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. I gotta be high before I can sway. Light a tea and let it be. If you a viper.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible by the Humboldt County Collective and Eco Groovy Deals. Thanks. We could not do it without you.
We could not do it without our sponsors. It's the Humboldt Chronicles. Happy Wednesday.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Chuck. This was a very interesting episode to put together. Yeah. So the idea that we had, I think about a month ago when we were brainstorming, was thinking about how the cannabis business worked in the 215 era.
Yeah.
And I know that I tend to sort of romanticize it a little bit, and it probably wasn't quite this easy, but it was not super difficult. A cultivator put some seeds in the ground, put some clones in the ground, grew them over the course of a season, harvested them, trimmed them, and sold them, and that was it.
And you're done.
That was it. And they, with the moment the plant left the cultivator's hands, money replaced it.
Right.
That was the transaction. It was fairly simple. And then what happened?
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And what happened after that?
Prop 64 happened with regulations from start to finish. And that's kind of what we're going to be talking about in this episode, is that bringing this commodity to the legal market meant a lot of regulations from the beginning to the end, and it's complicated. So it's not just putting the seed in the ground, growing it, watering it, and you know, and then you're done and you're off for the off season in Baja.
Exactly.
That's not happening now. And it gets complicated from cultivation to distribution to dispensary.
And in fact, not only is it much, much more complicated than it was in the relatively simple 215 era, but even comparing production and distribution of cannabis to production and distribution of any other type of product in today's economy, the cannabis supply chain is much, much more complicated, and maybe unnecessarily so.
Well, and we're gonna hear about that, even from not just the cultivators, but from a distributor as well. And you're right. It's so much more complicated. It's almost as if cannabis is being treated as a pharmaceutical business or something, because there are barriers all along the chain. And not only does it get complicated, it's, for the cultivator especially, expensive because they don't get paid on time like you would think in any other business.
Yeah.
So they have to carry some of these costs for a long time, which affects their families and just buying groceries.
Absolutely.
And so on. They have to go sometimes 30, 60, 90 days or longer. And sometimes they don't get paid at all.
Right. Right. Exactly. So so we're gonna start at the beginning. And I think as we go through this and we talk to the folks who are involved in this, one thing to keep an ear out for are the many different ways in which the cannabis business functions in a way that no other business really does, and sort of think, are these differences necessary, or are they an artifact of something artificial?
Well, it's a really good point. And you know, we knew when Prop 64 came to be that this was going to be a transition time, and it was going to be complicated, and it could be a little chaotic. And in fact, that's exactly what has turned out. So hopefully some of this will be taken care of over time. I mean, that's what we can hope for, right?
We hope. So we're gonna start at the beginning. We're gonna start when the seed goes into the ground.
So you want to be a farmer, huh? A cultivator. Get your hands in the dirt. A plot of land all your own. Making a living off the land. Outdoors. Fresh air. You're your own boss. And you say, now's the time. A legalized cannabis industry is what you've been waiting for. And really, how hard could it be? You put a seed in the dirt, you water it, it grows, you harvest it, sell it, you're done, right? No. This hour, a dose of reality, as we talk with a real cultivator who tells the real story about what it's really like. We'll also follow the grown product from farm to distributor to retailer and speak with Craig Najedly at Satori Wellness in McKinleyville. First, though, to the farm. This is Andalane Roy of DuPont near Honeydew.
We are cultivators in the cannabis industry, and we've kind of been on the forefront of the whole entire legal path. And my husband and I were both born and raised here, so we were born into the culture, and we're really fighting for our way of life and wanting to sustain our livelihood and who we are.
The fight for that way of life starts like this. Call it step one.
First, you got to source your clones and decide what genetics you want to breed and grow. And then you got to hire your team. We have several big pushes, and one of them is preparation for the planting time. So we're weeding and amending and turning soil, and it's a big process on 30,000 square feet. We used dark staffing solutions for the first time this year and brought in a team, and it got done super quick, and we were really thrilled with that. Usually we would have 2 to 3 employees, and it would take anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks to get it done. With our 6 to 8 employees from dark staffing, we were able to get it done in a week and a half.
But wait a minute, how do you know which strains to grow in the first place? That can't be just guesswork.
That's a really good question. And there's fads, you know, it's like sometimes a few years back, it was cookies. Cookies were really popular. Purple Mr. Nice. For the last 4 years, it's been OG. Everybody loves that gassy smell. And the first thing distributors do when they're looking at your product is they open it up and they put their nose in and sniff. So you kind of have to go along with the fads.
And that gets us to an intersection where cultivation and science meet. Genetics.
We've always done our own genetics and our own clones. And we're going to start doing that again, but this year we just had to source out. And it's a little nerve-wracking because it's hard not being in control, you know? If like you could bring one clone in and if it's got russet mites or if it's root-bound or unhealthy mom, my husband is very particular about those types of things. So outsourcing was really a challenge. We're picking up our first clones tomorrow, this Friday, and we're excited about that. So we'll see how it goes. We have a little greenhouse where we put our clones and grow them up, and sometimes we have to build a little extra shade barrier or a warmth barrier, especially this season. You know, as an outdoor sun grower, we're always fighting the natural elements, and this year has been a really cold spring, so we had to build a little extra structure to keep our seedlings warm. And then when we bring in our clones, because you're moving them from either an indoor environment into an outdoor environment, they have to be watched really carefully because that can kind of shock them and then put them into a downward spiral if they're not taken care of closely. So we build a protected area and grow them up. And when they're big enough and healthy enough, that's when we put them into the ground.
Into the ground is a milestone. Things are going well so far, but it's still early. Next, there's the task of caring for the soil. Think of it this way. The soil is the home those plants are now living in.
We have some garden beds in the native soil, and then we've reused our soil for like the last 10 years. We're always amending and building up the soil, so we plant cover crops to ensure that we have healthy soil for the next year. Well, and you have to think of it as its like own environment, and the soil, the plants, the greenhouse, the outdoors, you're creating this environment that needs to be healthy, and any number of things can affect the soil. So just going down from the strain that you're growing. So certain strains will pull certain things out of the soil. And my husband can go and like put his hands in the soil and literally smell it and kind of know, yeah, it's amazing, and kind of know what he needs to do. And he's like, this soil needs more of this and this soil needs more of that. Because we had to do wells, we've always used rain catchment and then water storage from our streams. And using that different water source definitely affected how we grow and how we do things. And that has been a big challenge, and that's what we worked with Dirty Business with, because it wasn't the actual plants affecting our soil, it was the water.
So that's just step one. Once the garden is planted, a whole new phase, or step two, kicks in.
We have a schedule where we check all the gardens in the morning, and we usually like open them up for airflow, and our SOP is, you know, open them up, look, listen, feel, and just kind of, and he kind of goes through his whole thing of like what he does. And so we check them in the morning, we check them in the afternoon, and we check them in the evening. And then it's watering, weeding, pulling leaves off, and whatever else needs to be done.
It's at about this time during step two that something which has been in the back of the mind moves and becomes a full-blown front of the mind concern, test anxiety.
The testing is a big challenge, and when you're growing, you're always thinking of that. So my husband, you know, he picks and chooses some of the nutrients, and we've also been working with a company to mix the nutrients for us. And I actually asked them, I was like, do you do phase three testing on your nutrients? Because a lot of times the companies that are making these products aren't held up to the same standards that we are. So we have to like double check everything. That's why even sourcing clones is nerve-wracking, because it's like you don't know what they used.
So what happens if you fail that test? Then what?
That's one of the scariest things, because we've been lucky enough to pass all of our tests, clean slate, that we're super excited about. But I do know a farm that didn't pass a test, and their product got held up for like 6 to 8 months, and they worked on a remediation plan, but the state is behind. We're kind of all building the plane as it flies. So it's like, here this person is. And it wasn't like a bad test. I think it was like too much mold or something like that. It wasn't like any pesticides or anything, but their product is locked, like in lockdown. If that happened to me at a particular time, that's something that could put us out of business, because of where we're at with compliance as far as all the money you have to spend on infrastructure. It's like if you have to move a greenhouse, or if you have to drill a well, or if you have to engineer a pond, if you're paying consultants, that's my scariest thing, is not passing a test. And you know, that's part of the challenge of growing, is like we're doing that to make sure we pass the test. I try to do a lot of education and meetings and talking with people and asking them for their SOPs on how they do it. I like to dot all my I's and cross all my T's and be prepared and do it right. My husband and I really pride ourselves in having quality product, and all these new adventures that we're taking to diversify, I want to maintain that same quality.
While all of this is going on, step three is looming out there on the horizon. Step three is harvest and distribution to the market.
There's preparing for cultivating and, you know, sourcing the clones, like I said, and then there's the growing period. And then you mentioned harvest. Well, harvest is another one of those big push times. It's really key as far as the quality of your product that's going to come out. So we always do a preparation of our plant. So it's really important to de-leaf and keep that airflow for our top quality flower that we're going to be putting in jars or selling to distro. We spend a lot of time de-leafing, getting that airflow. And then the way he dries and cures the product, he's got a whole system, and he's the only one that knows how to do it. And he's really good at it. We always have good smell, good product. And then there's processing. So harvest is preparing for harvest, then curing, which is super duper important. It's always a real high stress time for DuPoint, because we care so much. Like we want it to come out good. And in the sense, it has to come out good. There's a lot of competition. There's a lot of good growers in Humboldt County. And I would say there's a lot of competition to get your product to market, let alone Salinas Valley, that's closer to Los Angeles, where most of our product is going. But curing is a big, big step. And then also processing the cannabis. So once the cannabis is cured, it comes down into bins. We were doing on-site processing, but we're kind of straying away from that due to the infrastructure we have to build. Like we would have to build a bathroom. We have an ADA building, so when we need to do machine processing or something along those lines, we do that here. But as far as hiring, you know, 40 or 50 people driving out here on the mountain, on the roads, it just makes a lot more sense to have it done in town. And then people can go home. And and right now, there's been a lack thereof. One company that was getting up off the ground shut down due to these rules and these regulations. And there was really only one other processing center, well, that I trusted with my product, because I want it done a certain way. And my girlfriend was running a processing center in town, and they were actually contracting with farmers to get things processed. So I knew that it could go there and get done really, really well. And it takes a long time. It's a huge, I mean, well, that we call it processing for a reason. It's a process. So once it's processed and packaged, then it's ready for the distributors to come out and look at or take in and show them. And once you have your product ready to go, which we discussed, it's hard to even get it there. Once it's ready to go, working with the distribution companies in an ever-changing regulatory system makes it difficult to have leverage on pricing. And what I've seen from a cultivator perspective is the price is always being negotiated down and down and down. And even with the price increase, I didn't see it go up. And that was frustrating. So leverage, it's like there's no contracts, and trying to do business in a volatile market and you don't know what the consumers are going to want. And there just hasn't been much research.
There was no contract signed, Andelaine said. Although the landscape is beginning to change, still, in the cannabis industry, unlike in virtually every other type of business, the transactions between the cultivator and the distributor are generally not conducted with long-term contracts. Each deal is individually negotiated, which creates significant inefficiencies in terms of time and transaction costs. Additionally, without a season-to-season contract in place, the cultivator can have no expectation that what sells this year will sell again next year. And absent contracts, which are standard in every other business, the terms of a deal cannot be counted on. Even the final price of the product is not certain until the transaction is complete, which, as we heard earlier, can take 30 days, 60 days, or more.
They would be like, sorry, we have to lower the price on it. So the initial price that you negotiated always goes lower, but I've never seen it go higher. And an interesting thing happened over the last 3 months currently, where the price of cannabis actually went back up, and nobody foresaw that happening. And we went through a dry spell. So the product that I sold for $800 a unit was now selling for maybe $1,000 a unit. Did I see that price change? But I always see the price change go down. In there, you know, it's always like, oh, we got to go from $8 to $750. We got to go from $8 to $700. And I feel powerless sometimes. Like I have no control over my product, and it's very frustrating. And that's been one of the big challenges working in a legalized market.
If I'm an auto parts manufacturer and I send a load of mufflers to my distributor, they're not going to call me 30 days later and say, you know what, we're going to pay you half what we said. I mean, nobody would do business that way.
Nobody would do business that way. And that's why it's so volatile. And I feel like cultivators and even distributors and retailers, I mean, there's small retailers that are facing their own challenges, being small businesses. So it goes all over. And this is just my experience working with distribution companies. And no one's really wrong, but you're right. Who would do business that way?
We are just getting started. After a quick break, we're going to focus on what is arguably the most important customer of any cannabis cultivator in California, the distributor, the link between farmers and retailers. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles. In the first part of our discussion, we got from planting to harvest. We're talking with Andelaine Roy of DuPont, and soon we'll be joined by Craig Najedly of Satori Wellness in McKinleyville. Back to DuPont and Andelaine Roy, who, as a cannabis cultivator, cannot just harvest her crop and take it to a farmer's market stand on Saturday.
Really, it's a lot easier to grow blueberries and get it to the grocery store than it is cannabis, you know. They don't have the same regulations that we do.
No, her crop, by law, has to go to a distributor.
Specializing in wholesale flower, our customer is the distributor. Basically, our flower goes into their packaged product. So we've just worked really hard to work on long-term relationships with distribution companies. And some of them, when I first started out, and let's see, my first selling to a distributor was in 2016. And I think we had just started applying for our temp, and we had our affidavit from the county. And so all of our applications were in and we were ready to go. And I was all about local. I wanted to sell through all local distribution companies. How it was working with distributors is, You know, they wouldn't take a huge batch at a time, like 200 units of this, 500 units of that. It would just be 10 here, 30 there, and then you have to pay for testing on those 10. The fact that cultivators can't COA their own product is really frustrating, and a lot of times the distributors hold us to those testing costs. So when they're only taking 30 or 10 at a time out of a batch of 100, then you're paying testing costs. And so a lot of times distributors would try to do it in batches of 50 to 80 because that's considered a batch within the state of California, and you can COA on a batch of 50 units.
What is COA?
A COA is a certificate of analysis for the state of California that is clean compliance cannabis.
So yeah. The COA is what you get after it's gone through the testing process?
Exactly. And that, yes, that proves- but a cultivator can't do that. A cultivator can only do an R&D. So then my product goes with an R&D. A lot of times distributors don't even want to look at your product unless you have an R&D showing that it's clean. Once you have an R&D showing that it's clean, and the distributors are like, ooh, the THC looks great. We like the terpene profile. It's all clean. Yeah, bring it on in. Then you bring it in and they do the sniff and look tests. And if the product has been processed well, smells really great, looks really great, then that's kind of when you do your bargain. So then the distributor will take in a batch, or sometimes they'll travel to the farm and they come and open a whole bunch of units. They take their sample. They kind of give you a price point. They take their test. Once the COA is passed, has a passed test, then the batch goes into their possession. And
is it at that point that you get paid?
No. Or were you? No, that's another really challenging thing. A lot of times it would be like 30-day terms. And then distribution companies realized that farmers were struggling because it's like we're dropping our product off and not getting paid and not getting paid. So then we met with a few distribution companies that kind of changed the way they were doing their business, and it was cash on demand. So that's right when it passes the test and you drop it off. As soon as it passes the test, you would get paid. Those are my favorite. Those are my favorite kind of deals, because then you know what happens is like, okay, so say a distributor takes it in, it's like, oh, 30 days. It's kind of a volatile market. It went from here's the product, this is what we have, and everybody loved it, to consumers telling us, no, we actually want the OG gas. Now it comes from a consumer's perspective of what do the consumers want, and a lot of people are trying to read that market, and distribution companies were kind of doing the same thing. So if they took something in and it didn't sell right away, it's still in their possession because they did the COA on it. There wasn't really any rules if they could like deny it and give it back to you, but a lot of times the farmers don't want that. All the while it's sitting on the shelf, and cannabis does decline over time. And yes, there have been some times where I wasn't paid for over 6 months, and that was really frustrating. But there's no contract signed, so there was not much I could do about it except, can you pay me? Hi, it's Andaline again from DuPoint.
Okay, Larry, explain this to me. A cultivator like DuPoint, for example, goes to all the work and expense to grow this product that is market ready, but they can't take it to market. By law, it has to go to a distributor first. Is that right?
That is the case. They can only sell to distributors. They can't sell to end users. They can't sell directly to the dispensary. And as you heard, there's a period of time prior to the distributor actually purchasing the product from the cultivator where the product is in the hands of the distributor. Because for the way that they've set it up, the distributor is responsible for the testing, not the cultivator.
But the cultivator is paying for it.
Cultivator's paying for it. Cultivator turns the product over to the distributor. And also, as we heard, the distributors are, for market-based reasons, not buying large amounts of the product. They're not buying 300 units, 500 units. They're buying it in closer to maybe 20 units or 10 or 15. And this causes a number of problems. One is that, obviously, the cultivator is producing more than 10 or 15 units of any given strain in all likelihood. But two, each batch has to be tested separately. So you may have one crop raised in one greenhouse, and every single plant entirely the same. They might even be clones. Yeah. They might even be literally clones of each other. Mm-hmm. But you've got to test that one batch 3, 4, 5, 10 times, depending on how it's sold to the distributor.
And each test is another cost.
Each test is another cost. Which
plus what's tested is lost, right?
Some of it is lost, yeah. I think what I was told is the testing costs are around $750 to $1,000 per test, and it may be up to a pound or so product that's lost in the testing process. So, I mean, I can't think of any logical reason why one crop should have to be tested five times. And we also heard that sometimes you might send this one batch to three different testers, and get three different testing results. So there's not even consistency sometimes in the testing, which that totally makes no sense to me.
Can you retest again until you get a match with one of the other tests? Or what do you do at that point?
I don't know. I really don't know. I know that if you fail the test, that kicks in a whole other set of procedures.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether you have the opportunity to immediately say, wait, your test is bad. Let's retest it. So the combination of the distributor being responsible for the testing and just the market-based purchasing procedures result in a really kind of difficult and costly testing procedure, not to mention the time it takes.
Well, and still at this point, the cultivator has not yet been paid. Is that right?
The cultivator still owns it. They haven't transferred it to the distributor. They haven't gotten any money for it yet. They haven't even really finally settled on a price. They may have talked price at this point and sort of both come to some sort of agreement, but that, as we're going to hear later on, that's not necessarily the final price.
So how do you budget? You don't at this point, right?
That was the thing that I kept asking during the interview was, you know, there's quite a bit of planning that's necessary for this entire process.
Sure.
But in a lot of ways, it's tough to plan because you don't know, you really don't know what the market is going to desire.
Right.
When you're putting in your crop, is this thing that sold awesome last year going to sell awesome this year? You don't know. You don't know because you're not doing any of this pursuant to long-term contract with your distributors. The way that, you know, if I'm a manufacturer making Bic lighters, I might have a contract for 5 years and 300 million Bic lighters.
Right.
And I know what I need to produce.
Exactly.
I know the price I'm going to get paid.
Yep.
I know I can make my plan. I can order my materials. These folks don't have that advantage.
Well, you know, it's not that distributors are unaware of this. They are, and many are sympathetic, in fact. Among them, Craig Najedly, who's at Satori Wellness in McKinleyville.
A farmer is not even allowed to drive their own flower and product off their farm to a distributor unless they have a transport license. So the role is set up that a distributor has to come to the farm to pick up all that product, and then the testing is done at the distribution facility. So the distributor can't even send product to a testing lab. The testing labs have to come to the distributor. The whole interaction and testing has to be recorded. An employee from the distribution company has to watch the whole thing. And it takes time and just kind of somewhat silly.
As we've been hearing, both at the cultivator level and at the distribution level, there are quirks and peculiarities and inefficiencies that exist in the cannabis industry that other types of businesses just don't have to deal with. Here's Craig from Satori Wellness once again, describing challenges no other type of distributor faces.
Since there's no banking, we have to collect the payments from the shops in cash. And sometimes we don't collect payment right when we drop the order off. So really, it's that whole logistical paperwork and collections and dealing with the money and all that. That takes up probably over 50% of what distribution time is spent doing. Because we can't have UPS and FedEx just show up and deliver the orders. We have to drive around the whole state and deliver those orders ourselves. Any distributor that's operating probably has at least 5 vans driving around the state, and that's just another cost in doing business.
And although there may be some solutions on the horizon at the state and federal levels, the fact that cannabis businesses have difficulty opening bank accounts, a simple and fundamental process for any other type of business, complicates life for distributors and introduces unnecessary costs for security.
It's problematic. There's anxiety involved. I mean, you know, we've had incidences with drivers being robbed. You're automatically a target, you know, somewhere in like areas where crime's more prevalent. All they need to do is sit outside of a dispensary and watch a white van come up with no windows on it, and they know that, that they got a target. And it happens quite often. I mean, there's a lot of robberies in the cannabis side of business right now, mainly due to the lack of banking. Everywhere has to have security. Yep. Security is an issue, and there's just really no sense in not allowing banking, but that's what we're working with.
Obviously, then, the next question is, why all the silliness?
Just because it's cannabis. Yeah, just because of the stigma, and that's about it. I mean, when you really look at it, it's been quasi-legal for over 20 years, since 1996, with Prop 215 passing, and the proliferation since then. And I really don't see or know of any cases that there was a public safety issue. So really, it doesn't make sense that we're under this extreme hardship and testing and compliance and track and trace, when over 20 years of non-regulation never led to any big issues.
So Larry, it sounds like in order to appease everybody around the state, cannabis is still being treated with a little bit of reefer madness. Am I hearing that right?
I think you make a good point. It's a very difficult and specific testing procedure. I mean, one thing that people have said to me, and I remember hearing this especially from the people at Papa and Barkley, mm-hmm. is that one advantage of this really rigorous testing system is that the consumer knows when they purchase a product at the dispensary, that is a product that has been really tested and is really clean, more so than almost any other type of consumer product you can think of.
Yeah, and that's good.
That is definitely a good thing. I have to say, though, after talking to enough people, it does feel like the testing procedure is maybe a little bit more onerous than it needs mm-hmm. to be to accomplish its end.
Mm-hmm. I think Craig up at Satori Wellness agrees with you on that.
The inherent risks of pharmaceutical drugs versus cannabis are non-comparable in a sense. I mean, I would compare cannabis to basil, parsley, vegetable, gardening, agricultural products. You know, someone could have some mold or a bad run of flour, just as someone could have spinach with E. coli. I mean, there are those kind of issues, and that's good that testing exists for that type of thing to try and provide quality assurance. But all the other aspects and the regimen of metric and track and trace, to me, it's just overburdensome and not helping the industry or the farmer.
So the moral of this part of the story is silliness can and often does lead to inefficiency. Here again is Craig Najedly from Satori Wellness.
The biggest factor that I think is not benefiting the state at all and puts an undue burden on the distribution is paying the excise tax that the retailer is essentially collecting from the consumer. So it seems like since the retailer is collecting that tax, the retailer should be the one to submit that tax to the state. Instead of, I think it's really inefficient to make the distributor be a tax collecting agency. So we have to collect the tax and pay it from the cultivator when we take their product in, and then likewise from the retailer. So we're taking two different tax revenue streams, and then we have to keep them organized, and we have to facilitate paying those to the state, and we have to do that in cash. So you have to make an appointment, and they have like armed highway patrol troopers waiting for you to walk you into the building and all these things. And so the biggest inefficiency again goes back to not having bank accounts and having to be the tax collector.
As if that's not burdensome enough, how about the inefficiency of having to test some batches of product up to 8 times?
First, you'd have that 400 pounds, and the state set up a batch maximum of 50 pounds. So if you had 400 pounds, that's automatically 8 tests. You would have to turn that into 8 batches. Each batch is going to cost you between $700 to $1,000 to test. It could be the same exact product, because the state set up a 50-pound batch limit. You're going to have to test that same product 8 different times across that 400 pounds. And the sampling, it's a substantial amount. Out of 50 pounds, I'm going to guess, you know, off the top of my head, I'm not sure, about a pound. They have to sample it out of each bag.
We're nowhere near done with this discussion. On the way, we'll take a peek at the playing field and see whether we can tell just by looking whether it's level or not. Back in a moment. As we go to break, a cannabis calendar, a list of events coming up that you might be interested in.
Welcome to this month's edition of the Cannabis Calendar, brought to you by the Humboldt Chronicles. The calendar features information on upcoming cannabis-related conferences and events that take place within a day's drive of Humboldt County. As you may have heard, the High Times magazine and the Mateel have canceled this year's Reggae on the River. However, the High Times Cannabis Cup will take place this year, and it's happening this weekend at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. The event's website says to expect great tunes from Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros, Stick Figure, Twiddle, and other bands, along with hundreds of exhibitors, informative seminars with influencers and artists, high fashion, and maybe even some infused Ghirardelli chocolate. All the info at CannabisCup.com. From July 22nd through July 24th, the National Cannabis Industry Association's Cannabis Business Summit and Expo will take place in San Jose at the McHenry Convention Center. This event brings together more than 10,000 participants, including more than 400 companies on the expo floor and 150-plus speakers, including a keynote address by Canopy Growth Corporation founder and chairman Bruce Linton. More information is available at CannabisBusinessSummit.com. Finally, in mid-August, the 9th annual CannaGrow Expo takes place over 2 days in Palm Springs. Calling itself the ultimate weekend dedicated to the art and science of growing cannabis, the conference will feature a selection of 35 cultivation-focused education sessions led by world-class growers, networking opportunities with cultivators from around the globe, and a 125-plus booth expo hall with the latest tools and technologies for growing and extracting cannabis. The expo takes place August 17th and 18th at the Palm Springs Convention Center and Renaissance Palm Springs Hotel. Find out more at CannaGrowExpo.com. If you'd like to have your event listed on the cannabis calendar, email us the details at studio@humboldtchronicles.com.
You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. We're taking the pulse of the regional economy following the legalization of commercial cannabis roughly a year and a half ago. Our guests are Andalane Roy of DuPont and Craig Najedly of Satori Wellness in McKinleyville. One of the observations that's remained crystal clear during this economic transition is this. There are those who want to hold on to the Humboldt culture of the last 40 to 50 years while, at the same time, moving into the legal cannabis market. But some of those same folks are also worried that eventually big business will turn the industry, and by extension this area, into something that does not resemble the old Humboldt culture. Let's go back now to Andalane Roy of DuPont.
It was a whole back to the land movement that my parents and my husband's parents did, is they wanted to like live off the land, live a simple life, make enough money to support their families. It was never about, you know, millions and millions of dollars. It was about a way of life, a peaceful way of life. And that's how I've always seen the cannabis industry. And we really do, there is this misconception, you know, that bucket loads of money. It's just that's not my reality, and it never was my parents' reality, and it's not my neighbor's reality or my friend's reality. You know, we want to maintain our culture and our way of life and make a good living and be able to keep our properties and feed our families. I feel like we were talking about a lot of struggles and challenges. And one thing I want to say is I also feel like going legal has been one of the best things that has ever happened to me. I love my industry. I love meeting people that are excited about cannabis. And everybody I meet in my industry, it's very, really friendly, and I wouldn't say there's a bad rap. I mean, the sweetest people, we all hug. I've been inspired, especially with my local community, like in the Emerald Triangle, and watching us evolve and try to maintain being on the forefront of cannabis. And I'm proud of our county. I think they've listened really well, and they've tried their best to pave a way, even though it hasn't been the simplest way. It's been really challenging, but I think we all are working together on a same goal, and that would be economic stability for Humboldt County. And I hope we keep listening to each other.
Well, that's some powerful stuff. You know, Chuck, as I mentioned to you before, like when I was out talking to Andalane and visiting the farm,
yeah,
you know, there was a thought that I've had all along, but it was really brought home to me that, like, when the Prop 64 rules were first being implemented, there was a lot of articles in the press about how there were going to be winners and losers.
Yeah.
You know, some people will be able to make successful businesses out of this, some people wouldn't. And that's certainly true. But it was brought home to me that this is, in a lot of ways and for a lot of people, about a whole lot more than just business failure and success. I mean, for some of these people, this is a third generation mm-hmm. operation.
Yeah.
So we're not just talking about a business going under, which is tragic enough. I
yes.
mean, it could be someone's dream to start a restaurant.
Sure.
And the restaurant fails. That's a very difficult situation. But we're talking about an entire way of life.
Yeah.
Potentially disappearing for some yeah. of these folks.
Well, and remember back before Prop 64 went into effect, in the lead up to that, especially in this county, the discussion was, let's protect the small farmer for all the reasons you just mentioned, because it's not just business. It's about the culture and the values of this area. And so a lot of what was implemented in this county had to do with making sure that the playing field is level for the small operators. And the question is it or is it not? And we're still trying to find out about that.
Yeah, I think another question is, I mean, there were rules put in place that were intended to give the smaller operation a fighting chance.
Yeah.
But we can accomplish whatever we want in our county. But if the rest of California doesn't go along with that, you know, is the small farmer protected?
And then what do we do if they're not?
Let's get some perspective now on whether the playing field in the cannabis industry is level. From Craig Najedly at Satori Wellness in McKinleyville.
As a smaller operator, I think it's pretty fairly set up for anyone to enter. But definitely have to play your cards right and pay attention to what you're doing. But it's not like other states where they're only allowing like 3 licenses and you gotta show proof of funds. I think California set up a pretty level playing field, but like any playing field, if you have more money, you're going to have more advantage.
So Satori markets all over to hundreds of retail outlets. It's interesting, though, what Craig Najedly had to say about the Humboldt brand.
In terms of marketing your products, how important is the Humboldt name? Does that give you a marketing advantage?
You know, I would like to say it does, but the advantage, I think, is minimalized now, because there's so many people in the market, and when it was more black market-ish, people resonate with Humboldt, and you know, it's like, you can't get it, but when you get it, you got it. Whereas now it's like, it's everywhere. And I think Humboldt still has a legacy and it's still a good brand, but it's not what I use to sell my product, but I label it Grown in Humboldt all we can. So, I mean, there's still definitely value in it, and we got to keep that value. So we have a great environment for it. And I think we're going to really shine. And this is what I say to a lot of people, because Humboldt seems to be like feeling like they're constricted and farmers feel like they're being pushed out. But we have the cultural legacy of more accepting the business up here. Whereas all these big grows in Santa Barbara, especially right now, and I've seen this in talking with some people over the last year, is that that's going to fall out. And we're seeing that right now. We're avocado farmers. There's a huge just chaos going on. And Santa Barbara issued more temporary permits than any other county. And I think a lot of those are going to go away this year, because the community and all the other surrounding businesses are becoming super anti from what they're seeing. Whereas we have this cultural legacy of an Humboldt where, you know, some people might not like it, but they've learned to live with it, and they know it's a huge part of our economy and our culture up here. And so I think there's still it's still the best place to operate out of.
Larry, this discussion of the level playing field reminds me of an article that was recently in the Los Angeles Times about Santa Barbara County, where they found 147-acre farms, 83-acre farms. Around here, we're talking about feet, not acres, right? So it that's all allowed by Prop 64. Each locality can make its own decisions on these things. But it does make you wonder how small farmers here operating under the regulations in Humboldt County can compete with those big cultivators in places like Santa Barbara County.
Yeah, that was a really interesting article. And it came, the version I saw on the web came along with a video drone footage flying
yes.
over just, you know, row after row after row after row after row of these greenhouses. And
right.
it really puts you in touch with the scale that we're talking
right.
about.
I think that one was over 100 acres,
yeah,
as a matter of
incredible.
Fact.
Yeah, incredible. And I think it goes back to what I mentioned before. So Humboldt County has taken some measures to try to protect the small operator. Whether they're accomplishing that or not remains to be seen, but some of the regulations were made with that purpose. But if other areas of California don't have similar things, it seems like we're going to just get buried under the scale that we saw down in Santa Barbara. And that's why I talked to Angeline a little bit about the Humboldt County Growers Alliance, of which they're a part, HCGA, mm-hmm. who, by the way, were very, very helpful in helping us put together this episode.
They're doing really good work.
Yeah, and we want to say a big, big thanks to them for all their help. So I did talk to Angeline a little bit about what needs to be done at the Sacramento level to try to help out Humboldt County farmers, and here's what she had to say.
It's a brand new system, and what I would like to see is I think it's really important that HCGA has a lobbyist in Sacramento, and these companies need to start listening, and some of the laws have to be changed. So, and I'm talking from a perspective of like a small farmer, because a lot of us don't have $5 million to, you know, put into this ever-changing market and making these mistakes. Like, we have property mortgages and families to raise, and we weren't growing to be super rich. We were growing to sustain a wonderful way of life that we love. And I think that's why I'm still working through this crazy chain. It's like, I love it. It's our way of life. It's my culture.
We want to say thanks to our guests, Angeline Roy of DuPont and Craig Najedly of Satori Wellness in McKinleyville. Larry, some final thoughts. Did you learn anything in this hour?
Well, I guess, you know, one thing that I learned was that the distribution chain that exists in the cannabis industry is unlike the distribution chain for any other type of industry. And some of it makes sense because of the nature of the product. I think that some of it is in there because of the perception of the nature of the product, and one would hope that as industry people gain more experience, some of these more onerous things that do seem unnecessary will drop out through activity at Sacramento. But that, you know, I guess this is not a novel notion, but these folks are facing a very difficult challenge.
Yeah, and you know, anything legislatively takes time, and it makes me wonder how much time do some of these small farmers have to wait on Sacramento, which gets to the point of the local farmers needing a voice in Sacramento sooner rather than later, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think one reality is that no matter what happens, regulatory-wise, market-wise, no matter what, Humboldt County is not going to be able to compete on volume. Mm-hmm. We're not going to grow as much as they do in Santa Barbara. We're not going to grow as much as they can grow in the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to try to focus our lobbying, our legislative efforts on creating an environment in which a smaller producer can thrive. And hopefully these people who are third generation farmers, for whom this is their life, like, that can be preserved and they can keep going.
Very good point.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. This edition of the Humboldt Chronicles will be posted soon at 941lounge.com, lostcoastoutpost.com, and at iTunes for listening and downloading. Thanks again to our sponsors, the Humboldt County Collective and Eco Groovy Deals. We'll be back with the Humboldt Chronicles at 6 p.m. on the third Wednesday of each month. So we'll see you next time on July 17th at 6 p.m.